Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Scientists challenged the administration on the disappearance of BP's oil in the Gulf of Mexico, citing evidence of a 22-mile invisible plume below the surface. A new poll showed the percentage of Americans who believe incorrectly that President Obama is a Muslim has grown to 18% from 12% back in 2008, and new jobless claims surged to a nine-month high. Joining me in the studio for our Friday News Roundup, Dante Cheney of the PBS NewsHour, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Do join us throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning,
Diane.
Dante, I know you're in charge of the PBS NewsHour Patchwork Nation. You have a new book coming out about that. Talk about the jobless claims, and does this provide additional evidence that the economy is stalled?
I think the numbers do show that. I also think when you just go out there and talk to people, I just got back from, I was out in Eagle, Colorado, which is a town I've been visiting now for 2.5 years. And it's just, it is a fundamentally changed place. It is a very different place. When I first went to Eagle, Colorado, the concern was, were they going to have enough housing for the people that worked in the city? Because everything was so expensive. Where were the policemen going to live? Where were the firemen going to live? Where were the teachers going to live? That's not a problem anymore.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, values there have plummeted by some, like one-third or 40%, you know. And there's a lot of anger. And it's really interesting. The thing that concerns me when I see these numbers about the economy is so much of where we were for the last 10 years, manufacturing. I know manufacturing is coming back, and I think it's good that manufacturing is coming back, but it's not going to be what it was. And what really kind of pumped up the economy for a long time was construction. Those are good jobs. They pay well, and there are benefits. Those jobs are gone. And there are parts of the country where the entire economy was built around that, and those jobs have disappeared, and they don't know what they're going to do out there. Now Eagle, I mean, is just one place, but it represents a whole – I mean, this project that I do, it represents a lot of places around the country. You could go to Clark County around Las Vegas. You could see the same thing in Nevada. You could go out to Riverside in California and see the same thing. And that's just – you know, that really, really concerns me. The construction jobs and the unemployment numbers are just higher unemployment means less construction, and some it just gets to be a vicious circle.
Eleanor.
Well, in theory, we have a country with decaying infrastructure, and we have an economy that needs to be built on the industries of tomorrow, which is the new green economy, which is going to require a new manufacturing base. So I think these opportunities are out there. And the president came into office sort of staking his claim on injecting government money into the economy to get it going. He didn't get as much as he wanted, and I think many economists, and I think they're right, think that the remedies did not nearly meet the crisis that we're in. And now we're stalling out, and he's running into a wall of opposition. There's no appetite for more government money, and there's a rather small bill in the Senate that would create lending opportunities for small business that the Republicans are blocking, even though they support the goals of this program. So we've descended into total political warfare. And I think the lessons of the 1930s, when FDR pulled back on the gas pedal, the economy, and it sunk back into recession, depression. The World War II pulled us out of that, but we can't look at Iraq or Afghanistan to get us out of this. And it's really hard to see where the president, where he goes next, what the maneuvers are.
Byron York.
I think the new claims, we keep hoping every week that the number of new jobless claims will go down or will be fewer than it was before, and it just doesn't. And I think it shows the continuing potency of this as an issue as we head to November. I talked to pollsters over the last year and a half during the healthcare fight, during cap and trade, during immigration, during everything. And the pollsters were saying every day, if you're an elected official, every day that you're not talking about jobs in the economy is a time when you're on the wrong issue. Yeah. And I think what we'll see in the as the campaign heats up is that Republicans will claim that Democrats spent the last year and a half enacting an agenda that was not specifically focused on jobs in the economy. You can certainly say that about health care. Financial reform, they could certainly argue, was an attempt to try to prevent the kind of collapse that we had a couple of years ago. But this is a time in which President Obama and Democrats will be on the defensive from Republicans who will be attacking them for these continuing high unemployment numbers.
But at the same time, you did have the economic slowdown affecting the states, and many of those southern governors at first said they weren't going to take any stimulus money, and now big time they are
taking it. Well, they are. Some of them in Georgia and Louisiana and others are doing it. There was a principle behind it, which was the states are responsible for paying this, and they would have to expand the number of people to whom they give benefits, like part-time people. And the deal was a permanent expansion of the pool of people who would get these benefits in exchange for maybe 5-6 years of federal funding to do it. So some states thought that was a bad idea. Some were just some governors, Republican governors, were just philosophically opposed to the stimulus money. But the fact is now a lot of them are taking it.
Don,
and the other thing I'd say is, I mean, not to veer too far off into the political here, but, you know, look, the Tea Party is a problem for the GOP in some ways because they do need to be talking about jobs in the economy. In fact, everybody, it's 100% true. Everybody needs to be talking about jobs in the economy. And when we're not out there, people are tuning out. I mean, we may think they're tuning in. Maybe they're tuning into the mosque story. I don't know. But they're definitely, they are focused on jobs and unemployment. And something needs to be done about that. The problem is there is not an easy solution. So you're going to have a lot of people proposing things. I do think, you know, you can try to stimulate the economy in a couple different ways. But look, I think when you really look at what's going on in the country right now, we got in this situation over 30 years, you know, and it's going to take a long time to dig out of it. And that's a problem.
Right. The previous decade from 2000 to 2010 was a net minus in the creation of jobs. And so it's not only a recession, it's a transformation in work,
Absolutely.
The kind of work that we're doing. There is one bright spot, the bailout of the auto companies, which the president should feel vindicated. Maybe he'll get some credit, but probably not in this political climate. But a lot of jobs were saved. The car companies are up and running. GM put a stock offering out for the first time now in a while. And so that looks like that was a very good bet.
Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Dante Cheney. He's director of the PBS NewsHour's Patchwork Nation Project. He also is a journalist for the Christian Science Monitor. Byron York is chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. He's also a contributor to Fox News. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Eleanor, Dante mentioned the mosque. What is the media's role in this whole issue over the mosque?
Well, the media has an appetite always for the most extreme views because they make good television. And so you have the people, I think, who are really exploiting this issue politically. But Newsweek column this week, I spoke to Rick Schenkman, who is an historian. He teaches at George Mason. He's the author of a book called How Stupid Are We? It's about voting habits. But he makes the point that you cannot, public opinion is not like clay. You can't mold it. There has to be something there that exists. And the politicians have seen an opening here in the distrust that a portion of Americans have, a small portion but a somewhat growing portion, distrust of President Obama. And it goes into, you hear the phrase the other, the efforts to portray him as something not quite American, out of the mainstream. The McCain campaign flirted with that. It didn't work. The president got elected. And I think a lot of people thought we've congratulating ourselves as a nation. We've elected the first black president. If he could do that, he can do anything. And so the people around him worked very hard during the campaign to knock down all these rumors about whether he was a Muslim, that he wasn't born in this country. They let down on that. Once he got in office, they were worrying about the economy and the wars and other things. So I think a lot of this kind of flourished underground kind of fringe, and now it's popped out in the open with this controversy over the mosque. It's very unsettling, and yet the president, when he wades into it, Professor Schenkman explained to me, he's not seen as a disinterested observer because he has a Muslim father, whereas President Bush could go out after 9/11 and say, this isn't Muslim. The Muslims is a peaceful religion. Mm-hmm. And he comes from an old-line Protestant family. He didn't have like a stake in what he was saying. So there's a mistrust here that's taken root.
Byron, could former President Bush be of help here?
Actually, we saw something very interesting happening this week, which is a number of mosque supporters in journalism and elsewhere calling on George W. Bush to say something. Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post, Maureen Dowd of the New York Times said it's time for W. to get his bullhorn back again, which is a reference to Bush's famous speech on the Ground Zero on September 14th, 2001. It's possible he could, but Bush has very specifically not said anything about Obama's handling of the presidency, and he's not going to start now.
Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the oil spill. Welcome back. We have three journalists with us today. Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Dante Ginni of PBS's Patchwork Nation, as well as the Christian Science Monitor. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Let's talk about the oil spill. There are scientists out there who are challenging the administration, which has claimed that much of the oil has been cleaned up. Scientists are saying it's still there in the form of a plume. Byron.
This has been very confusing for us amateurs. I mean, as you saw the picture of the oil just gushing into the ocean, you think, well, that's got to go somewhere. And people were talking about this as being a historic environmental disaster. And then not long ago, the administration came out and said, well, three quarters of the oil is gone. We've either skimmed it, we burned it, or it has been dispersed by chemical dispersants or bacteria that are in the water that naturally consume oil. So you think, wow, maybe this wasn't so bad. Now there's a panel of scientists upon whom the White House was basing its work who said it's really kind of the other way around. It's not that three quarters of it is gone. It's about at least half of it is still there, and it is under the surface. Everyone had assumed that oil would eventually float to the surface. There appears to be this enormous plume of the stuff somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's really kind of confusing to know just how much is still out there.
But now you've got the response from shrimpers, from people who make their living from the Gulf. And you and I, as we go to buy seafood, especially shrimp, what's that going to mean for job seekers, Dante?
It's kind of interesting down in Louisiana because there are these people who work the docks and go out and fish, and that's part of the Louisiana story. But you know, when you really look at what Louisiana is all about, it's what really makes the state go. It's the oil. And that's why, as bad as things got, nobody in the Indiana state legislature was calling for an end to offshore drilling because they need the cash. What it means is right now they say they've tested the seafood from there, and everything they've pulled out so far looks good. I can't believe that people are just going to run out and start buying it again, though. And I do think that, you know, for the jobs down there, I can't believe that it's going to be a growth industry, especially in the Gulf for a while.
Eleanor.
Yeah, I think people will just be naturally wary. They're figuring the government may not be telling us the whole truth, that there is another shoe to fall here. And all those dispersants, I mean, I'm almost more concerned about the impact of those dispersants than the oil on oil. Yes, right. Yeah. So the story is far from over.
That's for sure. And we may not know the end of this for lots of years to come.
And how does this somewhat rosy scenario offered by the White House play into its ban on offshore drilling, which is something that people in Louisiana and other Gulf states have been very much against? I mean, if you can argue that we had what was arguably a worst-case scenario, this unbelievably disastrous, unstoppable flow of oil into the ocean, and a short time later, you've certainly had a lot of economic damage, but it's gone. It's harder, I think, for the White House to argue that you have to stop drilling offshore.
I don't think it's harder. It's political pressure.
The
other thing that I thought was fascinating in all the stuff going on this week was that some people were relieved that the microbes weren't eating the oil as fast as they were, because if the microbes were eating the oil too fast, they would have been robbing the area of oxygen, which actually would have hurt the fish supply. It's just when you get involved in these things, it's such a everything is linked. It's so complicated.
Let's talk about same-sex marriage in California. What's going to happen there, Eleanor, with the three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit issuing an emergency stay?
Well, I think the fact that the ban was overturned by the single judge initially, and some people thought they were able to get married, now there's a lot of disappointment because the stay is ordering the cessation of any marriages, and the anticipation is that this decision will wind its way up to the Supreme Court. And so I think it's probably wise that they did kind of put a lid on it for the moment. And politically, what I find interesting is I think the reaction to both decisions hasn't been as passionate on either side as it has in the past. I think there is a kind of a general acceptance of this.
That it's going to the Supreme Court.
And it kind of takes it out of the November midterms to some extent. We've got other wedge issues to fight about.
Byron.
Well, there's huge nervousness about – remember, gay marriage proponents were nervous about this lawsuit to begin with. And the reason they were nervous about it is because they didn't want to go to the Supreme Court and lose. For a while, there appeared to be some thinking in California – that Judge Walker's decision might just stand because he suggested that nobody really had the standing to defend Proposition 8 because the governor and the attorney general didn't want to do it. Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has basically said, let's just stop this. We'll look at the arguments. We'll see what happened. Maybe in December we will decide after the elections. And it has taken a pause. But the big concern on both sides had been if it goes to the Supreme Court. Because if it's a California decision, well, gay marriage is legal in California. It's legal in some other states already. If it's a Supreme Court decision, it's a national thing.
And what happens then to those individuals who are already married?
Well, couldn't the Supreme Court decide it's a state issue and let
that, absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
So
we could get that. That's definitely a possibility. What happens to the folks who are already married? It's I don't I That's very much up in the air right now.
I had understood that those marriages would be declared legal because it would be too complicated to overturn them.
To undo. Yeah, the only people who would do well are the lawyers.
Yeah, exactly. All right. And the lawyers were certainly involved in 20 months of pursuing former Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich, and one juror held out. What'd you make of that, Eleanor?
He or she has not been identified yet. And as Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor, goes forward, he's got to decide, is this lone person sort of a rogue? Mm. And can he take a gamble on having a new trial and getting a different outcome? Or is this mountain too high to climb, given the public relations reaction and the cost of money of a new trial? So I expect we're going to learn more about what went on in that jury room. But the fact that Governor Blagojevich went on that whole television media tour, reality shows and everything before the trial, apparently turning himself into a celebrity was a beneficial thing because people don't mind sending politicians to jail, but celebrities are another thing in this culture.
Actually, the Washington Post editorial page came out and urged Fitzgerald not to retry this case, which I think is good advice.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that that he lost, it was extremely expensive. Blagojevich has been convicted of a felony, and his political machinations have been exposed, and that the purposes of this have basically been served at this point. I think that's probably good advice.
In the past, though, when you have cases like this, when you have corruption cases, they are often retried and retried. I mean, this is not completely uncommon that you have the first trial and. You know, and he didn't get away. I mean, it's not, you know, he was found guilty of something. Yeah. This only one out of 24 counts.
Well, but, lying to the FBI.
Yeah. Right, lying to the FBI. It's 1 to 5 years.
What are the consequences of that guilty verdict?
He could go to jail. It's got an up to 5-year jail sentence.
So they're going to appeal that?
I'm sure he will.
Okay. And Byron York is author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. Just to remind our listeners, video clips of this hour, the Friday News Roundup, will be up on our website starting at 12 noon. Right now, you can join us, 800-433-8850. Here's a message from Jennifer on Facebook. She says, I wish you'd address how people are lumping all members of the Islamic faith in one group as part of the discussion. We have Catholics, Episcopalians, Mormons, and so on. Do we lump them all in the same category? Muslims come in all stripes, too. The terribly misguided criminals who bomb the World Trade Center are just like those terribly misguided Branch Davidians.
Right. That was very well said.
I think so. And why hasn't someone brought up the fact they already have a mosque in the same building they want to tear down and rebuild?
Right. And the imam who is leading the effort to build this mosque and Islamic cultural center is what they call it, is from the Sufi tradition, which is the sort of mystical tradition of Islam. It's not at all violent. And he already leads a mosque just, I think, 10 blocks away from the site they're looking at. And he's been there for 30 years. And he has Imam Rau, I think is how he pronounces the name. President Bush used him as an emissary. And he's currently, I think, in the Middle East for the Obama administration. This is hardly a radical. And the space that they're talking about has been vacant for ever since 9/11. The Burlington Coat Factory was there before, and yes, there are Muslim prayer services going on there right now.
Well, in a couple of things, you know, it's, and I think we in the media have done a real disservice into buying into the, to calling this a mosque controversy, because it isn't just, I mean, it is, it's more than that. They're trying to build a cultural center to heighten awareness of the different, you know, of awareness of Islam and what Islam's all about, and try to change the perceptions. That's the one thing. The other thing is, as much as we're all worried about this, they have raised, apparently, the money that has been raised for this, they are so far, they're light years away. I think there was a story in Politico this week that said they only have raised about $16,000.
One, on the Branch Davidian thing, I feel like I should address that. If memory serves, the Branch Davidians murdered 4 federal agents. The rest of the people who died in a standoff with the federal government. 3,000 people, as we all know, were killed on September 11th. Changed the politics of the world for a very, very long time. I think they're enormously different. There is a diversity of opinion.
The point is that there are radicals within various religious traditions.
There is a diversity of opinion on the location of this mosque in this place, even among Muslims. The New York Times published an article today kind of just talking to people on the street who were Muslims, and they all said, well, you know, it doesn't have to be there. It could be somewhere else. It could be farther away. And there is not this sort of locked-in cement. And the thing that actually shot this story into the stratosphere, it's been very big on the blogosphere and on cable TV, the thing that shot it into the stratosphere was President Obama speaking about it on Friday at the iftar dinner at the White House, appearing to give wholehearted approval of it, and then backing off a little bit the next day. That's what made the story really huge.
That's open to interpretation as to whether he was actually backing off in that next statement when he said, I don't necessarily support the wisdom.
You know, I talked to 3 of the people who were in the room at the iftar dinner, and I asked them all, well, what did you hear the president say?
Sure.
Did you hear him express support simply for the right of this group to build this mosque in this place, or did you hear support for the actual project? And they all said, we thought he was supporting the project.
I do think it's kind of odd, though, when we start talking about, you know, well, it's can we put it someplace else? I mean, are we gonna draw a boundary and say this is the hallowed ground boundary,
and
within which and what else are we gonna not allow other things in there if it's hallowed ground? Or you know, let's have to think about it.
Dante Chenia, the Christian Science Monitor, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's a question from Facebook. Is it true that 31% of Republicans think that President Obama is a Muslim? Why has a total lack of thinking and intelligence become the mainstream of the Republican Party? Is that true, Byron?
I'm looking at my Pew Forum report right now, and I believe it says roughly a third of conservative Republicans, 34%, say Obama is Muslim. So the number of Republicans is somewhat smaller than that, but it is a significant number, and more than Democrats.
It's conflated with the fact that they just don't like him and they don't like his policies.
That poll is really interesting, though. In independents, the number had risen. The number of independents who believed Obama was Muslim.
Can I give my theory on this?
Sure.
Obama is the first president with Muslim roots. And it's simply undeniable. And it was something that in the campaign, he came to public view, public prominence at a time of concern about interest in Islam among the American people, obviously after September 11th. During the campaign, it was something that they didn't want to talk about. Critics could face ostracism simply for pronouncing the president's middle name. After he becomes president, he goes to the Middle East in June of 2009 in his much-anticipated outreach to the Muslim world, in which he stresses his Muslim roots. And today, the president on Sundays can often be seen going to play basketball or golf. And it's not any surprise to me that a number of the American people would be confused about what his religious status is. By the way, the poll found that the number of people who did not know what Obama's religion is had risen significantly.
But didn't Al-Qaeda attack us? I don't believe it was the Muslims.
There was enormous interest in Islam and what it means.
The other thing in that poll, though, it's also among liberal Democrats. The number of liberal Democrats who declared they did not know the president's religion had risen. And I do think. Look, this isn't a question of whether or not it's right or wrong, but you know, the president obviously has not made religion as much has not brought it to the forefront of who he is, particularly the way the former president did. And I think there was no way, if you ask people what religion George W. Bush was, we all knew.
I want to ask, what difference does it make?
I think it's a valid question.
What religion the president of the United States practices. I don't understand that. I don't care if he's an Episcopalian, a Methodist, a Jew. I don't care. We elected the man president.
Well, interesting, in that, I think in that poll they also found that Judaism was the most respected religion. I mean, here's a country where we've had some anti-Semitism, and so it now looks like anti-Muslimism is becoming the new anti-Semitism. I think, you know, that's the contrast to President Bush, who to many people thought that he overdid
his religion.
And Pew polled that kind
and
of stuff,
President
too.
Reagan didn't go to church, and that didn't seem to bother anybody. So maybe if it's conservatives who are the most upset here, if it's one of their own who doesn't go to church, it doesn't matter. I don't know. This is,
find myself
emotional.
Wondering about the fact that right after the president was first elected, Rush Limbaugh began to call him President Hussein Obama. And yesterday, on the air, he denied he had ever used that word. I heard him.
Yeah.
I heard him. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, your calls, your email.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The last U.S. combat brigade leaves Iraq. The U.N. calls for more international aid for Pakistan's flood victims. And China is projected to overtake Japan as the world's second largest economy. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. Byron York is here. He's chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner, also a contributor to Fox News. Eltner Clift is with Newsweek. Dante Cheney is director of the PBS NewsHour's Patchwork Nation Project. Let's go first to Audrey in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
Okay. My question is about the mosque controversy. The question is, who benefits from the normalization of Islam? You know, why is the media working so hard to be for or against Islamic anything? And if you are an American in a country that's based on, you know, religious freedom, where most people have ascribe to some form of religion here over the years, why should Americans be offended when they seem to be in a position where you know, when the media talks about religion, everything involving Christianity is wrong, from gays to the in the Episcopal Church to pedophilia in the Catholic Church to polygamy in the Mormon faith. But when it comes to those poor Islamic people, oh, my God, you know, we're doing this terrible thing. So that's my question.
All right. Thanks for calling, Dante.
I don't know if anybody would jump up and say that every aspect of Islam all around the world needs to be defended. There are obviously aspects of Islam that people that disagree with, rightly so, that are radical and scary. But to me, the question is, the question is, why should they? It is a legitimate question to say, why should they not have the right to build something there in a country with religious freedom?
Byron,
you know, I think there is a consensus about the legal constitutional right of this group to do this thing if it can get through the zoning, which it apparently has, and if it gets the money, which it hasn't. And we should mention, by the way, that there are two buildings involved that would go down and a new building would be built. The group that proposes to build the mosque owns one of the buildings, and they don't own the other building, and they will have to buy it, and they don't have the money to do it. The chances of this happening are not really big.
All right, to Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning, Shauna.
Hi, good morning, Diane, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a few comments on the contradiction in our views as Americans on the economy. On one hand, we decry the unemployment rate, but on the other hand, we condemn the government for spending to try to help that unemployment rate, but then we get back to blaming the government for not doing enough for this unemployment rate. And my second comment is, we as news people owe it to the public to tell the truth about the source of the recession. You know, I agree with the panelists that the media has been doing a disservice by not being forthright and discussing many issues in detail. We are not, as media people, supposed to be gossiping like teenagers. We are supposed to be the leaders on what should be talked about, even if the truth is sometimes boring. I think we owe it to say it. And I agree completely with your question, Diane. Who cares what the religion of the president is? I mean, when we get to arguing about his religion, I think we are ignoring so many other pertinent issues out there.
Thank you, Shauna Elner.
Well, it is August, and it seems that every August there's some what I would say is a peripheral issue that gains credibility in the media. And the cable news stations, it's sort of like standing around the water cooler. It is very gossipy, as the caller said. And, you know, religion is something that gets people's passions going. And so it doesn't surprise me that this has taken off as an issue. Now, I would only hope that by the time people go to the polls in November that they're going to be thinking about something else.
I thought she made a good point when she talked about the government trying to help not being able to help and then being criticized for not helping.
Well, she put her finger on the dilemma of government and economic policy right now, which is the Obama administration says, and I believe everyone agrees, that current spending levels or current deficit levels, if they were to continue, are unsustainable, which means they can't go on. So there is actual, legitimate, real concern about the deficit. There's also a general consensus that in a downturn like this, the government ends up spending more money. In the debate over the stimulus of 2009, Republicans had a plan to, I think they called it twice the stimulus at half the price, but they were still going to spend a lot of extra money as well. So you've got this just head-to-head conflict between the need for the belief that extra government spending will help pull the economy out of the ditch and growing legitimate concern about the size of this deficit.
Dante.
And I really do agree with the caller about, you know, the thing that Byron was saying about whenever a politician isn't talking about the economy, they're doing a disservice. I actually think we in the media have not handled this story well. I really don't think we're reporting on what's going on in the economy properly. And I think the caller is right. I mean, it's there needs to be more explanation as to what's really going on.
And why.
And absolutely.
And the notion that you could turn it around in a year and a half.
Right. I'm telling you.
I mean, the president has got to go on the campaign trail and ask the American people for patience. But it would help if we in the media did a better job of explaining how these things work. I agree.
Miami, Florida. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. Good morning. Two quick comments. I just wanted to say I am a real estate developer, African-American, young 30s, and 2 points. You guys said, what does it matter with religion? I'll tell you why it matters. The Episcopal Church, Baptist Church, the, you know, you name it, Methodist Church, none of them have a component that threatens or wants to kill off another religion or another believer. So you do want to know where they're based. That's one. The other thing is, in terms of the mosque, anytime I'd like to build or have a project that I'd like to build something, right? When I go in, zoning says to me it has to be approved, and zoning has the final word. And if it is not in line with what they want for that block, that community, whatever that area is, I am denied. It is not based on religion. It is not based on anything of that matter. It is it what we want in this particular community? Is it going to be what's best for the people that live in that community? So it's kind of odd. And the last thing is, someone said about, I am a Democrat. I still believe that there is a component tied to Mr. Obama with his Muslim belief. So everything you said, pretty much, when they talked about 31% of Republicans believe it, it's not all Republicans. There are Democrats, there are independents who believe that as well.
Michelle, I'd be interested as to why it is you believe that President Obama is a Muslim.
Well, I think your gentleman on there just explained it very well. He's much better than I could ever do. I mean, he gave you the example of the name. It's in his history. He said it. He's been tied to it as a young man. And then his speech, as well as everything else your guy there just explained. So it raises questions. It makes you say, wow. And then when a president comes out and makes a comment about a mosque, which to me should have stayed away from that, it really kind of confirms that there may be some tie-in to this belief.
Interesting, Byron. Yeah,
in Dreams from My Father, Obama's memoir, he describes 1985, he moves to Chicago to become a community organizer. He goes to Smitty's Barbershop on the South Side, gets his haircut. At the end of the haircut, Smitty asks him, what's your name? And he says, Barack. And Smitty says, Barack, you a Muslim? And Obama says, my grandfather was. And it's been a question that has popped up with him many times. And I think what has happened now is, because of what I was explaining earlier, there are people who do not make the distinction between Muslim roots, which he has, and Muslim, which he's not.
The other thing that really should be said is what Episcopal Bishop Chain said on this program the other day, when someone said, Christianity has never been involved in violence. Whoa! Think back, folks. Think back to the Crusades and the hundreds of thousands of people who were killed in the name of Christianity. And I don't think that's something we can avoid. Let's go to Haverhill, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Brian, I like you a lot. You're a rational,
thank you.
smart, rational, conservative. But, Brian, you really have to admit, though, about Fox News. I mean, from on and tonight, from Fox News and Friends in the morning and all day long and in the evening, they just there's nothing good that they can say about Barack Obama. Even trivial things they criticize him on. It's just constant, all day. There's such a thing as constructive criticism, but
So, Richard, what's your question?
Well, my question is that he has to admit that Fox News is adding fuel to the fire on a lot of these things.
What do you think, Byron?
Well, I think there are a lot of voices on Fox News who are leading voices of the opposition, there's no doubt. And this is a time the opposition does prosper when a president of the opposing party comes in. I think if you went back and looked at the coverage of President Reagan in 1981, 1982, pre-cable news, so it's not pre-talk radio, so it's not completely analogous. But there was enormous, withering criticism of Reagan all the time in a media that was dominated at that time by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the three broadcast networks. So it's a very, very partisan time.
I think the Fox News is more forward-leaning than the New York Times ever was when it was assessing the Reagan presidency. And the fact that Fox News has given $1 million to the Republican Governors Association is sort of – they're putting their money – right.
In the person of Rupert Murdoch.
Right. They're putting their money where their mouth is, to put it
in that way. Rather unusual.
Well, the scale of it is unusual, and the openness of the partisan commitment is unusual.
I mean,
yes.
In the past, hasn't it been sort of 50% to Democrats, 50% to Republicans?
Well, News Corporation says that they simply do not, the parent corporation simply does not determine the editorial positions of Fox News, which I believe to be true. It's General Electric, which owns NBC and MSNBC, says the same thing. And I believe that their contributions have been somewhat lopsided. They've contributed to both, but more to Democrats in the past several years. But it's always a question when the parent corporation of a news organization does something is whether that affects the actual editorial product that comes at the end.
Let's see. Mm. Since last year, NBC's parent corporation, GE, donated $245,000 to the Democratic governors, $205,000 to the Republican
governors. That's just the
governors.
Last year.
Yeah, last year. But this year, Rupert Murdoch gave $1 million to Fox News.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, we're all sitting here and we're kind of dancing around this. I mean, look, I don't think a lot of people are terribly surprised by this. I think that the people who oppose Fox News on the left probably look at this and say, well, you know, what do you expect? That's what we've known all along. And, you know, Rupert Murdoch is free to do what he wants with his money, and News Corp is too. I mean, you know, they're free to do this. It's out there now. Everybody's seen them do it, and it's going to feed into the perception of Fox News. If Rupert Murdoch is fine with that, you know, God bless him.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. There's been a fair amount of email this morning about Dr. Laura Schlesinger. And I am wondering how you're all reacting to the fact that apparently she used the N-word on the air 11 times. NPR talked about it this morning during Morning Edition. I found myself, and she not only has said she's going to retire at the end of the year when her contract runs out. I found myself looking at this in sort of a broader philosophical way, wondering whether somehow we've let loose a kind of prerogative to be as free as we want about damning other people.
Well, we've had a debate for a long time about political correctness, but the fact that she is claiming that her First Amendment rights are abridged because she can't repeatedly say a word that has a long history of being very offensive to a lot of people. I mean, I just don't see that her First Amendment rights are abridged. And when Sarah Palin comes out with this long defense of Dr. Schlesinger and uses the phrase that she should be unshackled, which is a word that Sarah Palin used for herself. She felt during the presidential campaign, the McCain campaign, was shackling her. I mean, these are powerful words for, it seems to me, very minor abridgments on what they're saying.
So what was the tweet that Sarah Palin sent her?
She said her tweet was that Schlesinger should reload.
Byron.
I did listen to the audio of her exchange with the listener, and it was really quite hostile. And it's not a First Amendment issue. She doesn't have to quit the radio. She may not quit the radio. She said she's going to do it in the end of the year. Maybe she won't. So it's not a First Amendment issue. But it is just simply a fact that unless you are a comedian like Chris Rock or a rapper, this is simply not a word that you can say in public. And her use of it, like I said, a hostility came through as she was saying it. And so it's just another – this has actually happened in other cases. It's not a career advancer to do something like that.
You know, there are other words you can't say too. I mean, it's not like it's not like, oh, you know, they're clamping down on me because I said this word. No, there are other words that you simply cannot say repeatedly on the radio and not get in trouble. And I don't understand – I don't – you know, there – it's not like she can say what she wants in her own home and to friends, but when you're talking on the radio over the airwaves, there are things you cannot say, and she should know that.
Be thoughtful. That has got to be what you do on the radio. Dante Chinnia, the PBS NewsHour's Patchwork Nation Project, Eltner Clift of Newsweek, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and contributor to Fox News. Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And enjoy your weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.